Welcome to the debate. Look, if you look at the control room of any massive complex system, say a national power grid or a global shipping network, what you see is just this complete, total obsession with parameters.
Right. And necessarily so, right? I mean, it is entirely driven by metrics, frequencies, load capacities, margins of error, supply and demand curves.
Yeah, and it is clean. It is mathematical. The system is either within its operational bounds or it is failing. You can point to a dashboard and see exactly where the constraints are holding. But, well, here's the problem. You step out of that pristine control room, you walk out onto the street, and suddenly that mathematical architecture just, it dissolves.
Because the dashboard doesn't tell you why a community is grieving.
Exactly. It doesn't tell you why an ecosystem is quietly collapsing, even though the economic metrics on the screen are flashing green and looking incredibly healthy.
Yeah, the formal architecture tells you the system is technically functioning. It coordinates the logistics. It just does not measure the phenomenological experience, you know, the actual lived, felt reality of the human beings operating inside it.
Right. And this tension between the dashboard and the human reality on the street is the exact focus of Dr. Bechara Sahali's work on how we navigate our current civilizational crisis. Today, we are asking a massive question: Are we going to save civilization by doubling down on data, margins, and what Sahali calls an architecture of viability?
Or do we need to radically change our entire approach and adopt a living grammar of life calling, where we structure society around felt human needs and relational gifts?
So just to lay my cards on the table, I'm taking the stance that our survival depends on ditching this rigid, hyper-formal architecture for a more relational, felt grammar based on life value and gift language.
And I am taking the stance that relying on phenomenological calls and rejecting formal exchange mechanisms actually risks diluting the rigorous constraints we absolutely need to manage complex global systems.
Because if we keep relying on the dashboard, we are going to measure ourselves right into extinction. And I know you're looking at me like I'm crazy right now because.
I mean, I kind of am. Because if we rely on subjective feelings and relational warmth to run a global supply chain, we are going to starve.
I don't think it's just about feeling warm and fuzzy, though.
But while the language of the call and the gift is beautiful and it's emotionally resonant, a viable civilization cannot be engineered primarily on sentiment. I mean, human perception is incredibly fallible. We need the cold, formal constraints of economics, margins, and state regulation precisely because they act as a safeguard against our own cognitive blind spots.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it a bit differently. I don't think the call is just sentiment. I think formal architectures of viability are profoundly incomplete because they measure without actually understanding what life is. We have built systems that grow exponentially while destroying the very conditions of life that make growth possible.
But we really need to define what we mean by the call, because this is where the translation from formal mechanics to subjective experience begins in Sahali's text.
Yeah, let's do that. To understand the call, we have to look at how the biologist Terence Deacon defines the concept of absence.
Right, the idea of what is missing.
Exactly. In formal systems, we only ever look at what is present. Here is the data, here is the money, here is the inventory. But Deacon argues that living systems are actually organized by what is not yet present.
Meaning they are organized by a deficit.
Yes, a cell is organized around the nutrient it hasn't obtained yet. A body is organized around the wound that hasn't healed yet. But in lived human experience, that absence isn't some abstract mathematical vacuum. It is deeply felt. A crying infant isn't, you know, an abstract deficit in caloric intake.
Right, obviously not.
It is a call. A dry riverbed isn't a hydrological variable on a spreadsheet. It is a call for repair.
And you are arguing we need to build civilization around answering those calls.
Yes. Think of formal systemic architecture like the blueprint of a house. The blueprint is necessary, sure. It tells you where the load-bearing walls are, where the plumbing goes. But the blueprint is entirely incapable of describing the warmth, the safety, and the lived reality of the home inside it. Absence must be translated into a call, into need, towardness, mattering, because that is the actual mechanism by which life mobilizes a response. We don't respond to blueprints. We respond to crying children.
I come at it from a different way. The blueprint analogy is lovely. It really is. But let's apply it to reality. If we abandon the structural blueprint to focus purely on the feeling of the house, how do we distinguish a true call of life from a manufactured desire?
What do you mean by a manufactured desire?
Well, this is the immense danger of phenomenological or feeling-based language. Modern consumer culture is an absolute master at training the human nervous system to experience every single impulse as a legitimate existential call. An addiction feels like a deep, vibrating absence.
Mm-hmm.
Status competition, you know, the urge to buy a luxury car because your neighbor got one, that feels like a call. The endless scroll of social media outrage feels like a call you absolutely must answer. If we govern society by responding to calls and felt needs, we risk engineering a civilization that merely caters to the loudest, most manipulated appetites, completely mistaking them for vital needs.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. You are perfectly describing the pathology of our current system, but you are blaming the cure. This is exactly why the call cannot exist in a vacuum. In Saheli's framework, it has to be tethered to philosopher John McMurtry's primary axiom of life value.
Which is what, exactly? Let's translate that for the listener.
So McMurtry argues that value isn't just subjective preference or market price. A true call is empirically testable. He defines life value as any action or provision that opens a more coherently inclusive range of thought, felt being, and action. And disvalue is what closes, disables, or destroys that range.
Okay, so give me a concrete example of how we test that in the real world.
Take your social media example. The algorithm manufactures a call, a notification that sparks outrage on your phone. You answer it by scrolling for 3 hours. Does that open a more coherent range of thought and action?
Usually the opposite.
Right. No, it disables your attention, it spikes your cortisol, and it isolates you. That is a false call. It generates false capital. Compare that to a community where the local water filtration system is failing. The people are getting sick. That is a genuine absence. Fixing that water system opens up their capacity to live, work, and thrive. Life value allows us to distinguish between a manufactured desire that narrows our capacity and a genuine life call that provisions the universal necessities of life.
Okay, but this introduces a massive mechanical problem. Let's say I agree with you conceptually. Let's say we must respond to these true calls based on life value. How do we actually filter the overwhelming barrage of signals in the world to do that?
What do you mean? We look at what is broken and we fix it?
It is not that simple. We are a global society of 8 billion people. We are bombarded by millions of data points, demands, and disturbances constantly. You need a mechanism to sort them. Gregory Bateson famously defined information as a difference that makes a difference. In a formal architecture, we use objective metrics, like price, to sort signal from noise.
And you think price is an effective filter for human needs? Because if you do, I have a bridge to sell you.
Very funny. But yes, I do think price is a highly efficient, decentralized mechanism for transmitting a difference that makes a difference across a massive, complex network. If there is a copper shortage in Chile, the price goes up, and a manufacturer in Germany instantly knows to use less copper. It happens automatically.
Sure, for commodities.
But if you dismantle that and demand that all differences be judged by some standard of life coherence or true calls, you're effectively dismantling decentralized coordination. You risk establishing an authoritarian control over the meaning commons, where some central body of experts has to sit around and decide whose call is legitimate and whose is counterfeit.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because you are assuming that our current formal metrics, like price, are actually filtering reality accurately. They're not. They are producing what Saheli calls counterfeit relevance.
So, the copper example works perfectly well for organizing a supply chain.
Because the price mechanism only sees what can be monetized. It is a pathological filter. It amplifies what is profitable or sensational, like spectacle, outrage, and quarterly earnings, while entirely suppressing slow, relational signals that actually matter for survival.
Give me an example of a suppressed signal.
Look at an old-growth forest. The price mechanism, your decentralized filter, sees that forest purely as timber value. It registers a signal only if we cut the trees down and sell them. It is utterly blind to the forest's value as a watershed, a carbon sink, a habitat, or a commons for future generations.
Well,
a dashboard will show a massive spike in GDP from the logging industry while completely ignoring the slow collapse of the ecological threshold. Bateson's pattern that connects is broken by price. A difference only truly matters if it helps life perceive what is broken and coordinate a repair. If your economic metric filters out the cry of the vulnerable because they don't have purchasing power, your architecture of viability is actually an architecture of suicide.
It is imperfect, I grant you that. It completely misses externalities like ecological damage, unless we formally price them in, which is exactly what regulations and margins are for. But it coordinates human action without requiring everyone to share the exact same moral framework.
But the moral framework of equivalent exchange is destroying us, which frankly forces us to look at how we actually communicate and answer these calls. I am proposing we move away from structured exchange as the foundation of our civilization.
And replace it with what? Barter?
No, with the mechanism of language itself. We look at Genevieve Vaughn's theory of language as a gift. She argues that language fundamentally evolved as a gift, given to satisfy a communicative need. It is rooted in what she calls the mothering ground of unilateral provision.
Let's pause and unpack unilateral provision.
It means giving without expecting an equivalent trade. Think about a parent and a child. A child does not buy a word from a parent. The parent gives the word gift unilaterally so the child can orient to the world. And words don't diminish when they are shared. They actually create a common world. The argument here is that we have to shift our civilizational paradigm from homo economicus, you know, the human viewed fundamentally as a calculator trying to get a fair trade, to homo donans, the human viewed as a giver and receiver of life and meaning.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
Go ahead. I mean, I'll admit, reading Vaughn's idea of a purely gift-based language scaling up to macroeconomics, I struggled myself to see how this doesn't just lead to massive exploitation of the givers. But tell me your concern.
My concern is exactly that, but on a global scale. Framing language and interaction as a unilateral gift works beautifully in a localized setting, a mother and a child, a small village, a tight-knit community. But scaling homo donans to a global economy is not just naive, it is dangerous. Sahali's own text explicitly warns against coerced sacrifice.
Yes, where people are forced to give continually while the system extracts.
Precisely. If you strip away the structured equivalence of market exchange, who ends up doing all the giving? Historically, it is women, caregivers, colonized peoples, and ecosystems. They are forced into this mothering ground, constantly provisioning the world unilaterally, while those in power extract from them. Market exchange, with all its cold, formal flaws, provides structured boundaries. It says, I give you X, you give me Y. We are square. I am not obligated to bleed myself dry for you.
But that is exactly what the current market does. It bleeds the working class and the environment dry.
But mechanically, how do you replace it? How does a complex, scale society provision goods globally? How do we build MRI machines, microchips, and massive public infrastructure without the structured equivalence of exchange? Are Intel engineers just going to give away processors because they feel a phenomenological call to participate in the gift economy?
No, and that is a mischaracterization of what a gift provisioning economy actually is. We get there by first recognizing that our current concept of money has become a damaged language. It misnames value. When you rely solely on equivalent exchange, you convert the deeply plural, complex grammar of life into a singular, flattened syntax of price. A nurse's care, a teacher's patience, a river's flow, all flattened into a dollar amount.
Okay, but again, mechanically, how do we get the MRI machines?
The text does not argue for abolishing the economy or plunging us back into a localized barter system. It argues for reorienting the purpose of the macroeconomy. In this model, the civil commons acts as the answering field.
Meaning what, in plain English?
Meaning public health care, clean water systems, ecological protections, universal housing. You prevent the coerced sacrifice you are so worried about by structurally ensuring that the commons provisions the universal necessities of life for everyone.
You don't ask the Intel engineer to work for free. You stop treating human care and ecological stability as unpaid externalities, and you reorient the massive wealth of society to ensure that the baseline capacity for everyone to live and give is continuously replenished. You protect the giver by making sure their basic life value is never dependent on whether they can sell their labor in a market.
That's a compelling argument. But have you considered the sheer structural irony of what you are proposing? Protecting the giver, building this robust civil commons where healthcare and housing are universally provisioned, requires incredibly rigid formal constraints.
What do you mean?
You cannot protect a global civil commons with a warm grammar of calls and gifts. You protect it with hard laws, strict tax margins, objective legal frameworks, and rigorous state regulation. You protect it with the exact architecture of viability you started this show arguing against. If a corporation tries to dump toxic waste into your civil commons, you don't fight them with a word gift. You fight them with a regulatory injunction.
Right, I hear you. I am not saying we abandon laws. I am saying those laws and regulations must be written in a grammar that actually recognizes human developmental reality rather than just market efficiency. Which brings us to the ultimate friction point. How does this phenomenological approach scale up to prevent civilizational collapse and war? Because even if we establish this civil commons locally, you still have the problem of conflict. How does a warm grammar of gifts prevent a superpower from invading a neighbor?
Exactly. How does a feeling-based grammar secure global peace?
By addressing the neurobiological root of the violence. You cannot build a peaceful civilization out of dysregulated nervous systems. This is where psychologist Darcia Narvaez's concept of the evolved nest becomes critical civilizational infrastructure.
The evolved nest. Explain that for us.
Narvaez looks at human evolutionary history and identifies the baseline conditions a human child needs to develop properly. Touch, play, rapid responsiveness to crying, multiple nurtures, deep connection to nature. This isn't just some private modern parenting checklist. At its core, Narvaez is pointing out that a stressed, traumatized childhood literally wires the brain for conflict.
So under-nested children become aggressive adults.
Exactly. They become dysregulated. Because their early calls went unanswered, their nervous systems are chronically locked in a survival state. They become prone to what the text calls fear languaging. They are neurologically primed for domination, for addictive consumption, and for enemy making. If you want Johann Galtung's concept of positive peace, which isn't just the absence of war, but the active presence of answered human need, you cannot achieve it if your population's brains are wired for war from infancy. The civilizational blueprint has to start with the nest.
That is a profound psychological insight. But again, apply it to the architecture of a global society. Consider the immense fragility of relying on universal re-nesting as your primary civilizational safeguard.
Why is it fragile? It's the most robust foundation we have.
Because humans will inevitably experience trauma. Natural disasters happen. Scarcity happens. Broken relations happen. Parents get sick. If your blueprint for civilizational renewal requires achieving universal psychological coherence through perfect childhood nesting, your civilization will collapse the moment a severe crisis hits because people will become dysregulated.
I'm not demanding perfection. I'm demanding it be the structural priority.
But the moment the nest breaks down, what holds the line? This is precisely why we need cold, rigorous, formal systemic constraints. Strong borders of accountability, objective legal frameworks, structured market exchange, and formal state power are vastly more reliable safeguards against violence than hoping everyone has a perfectly healed inner child. We build the architecture of viability to constrain the worst of human nature, knowing that trauma is inevitable. The formal architecture holds the line when the evolved nest fails.
But don't you see the loop we are stuck in? The formal architecture causes the nest to fail. When your macroeconomic dashboard misnames austerity as efficiency, it demands that parents work 80 hours a week just to pay for basic housing. That strips the nest of time, presence, and care. The architecture creates the very trauma, the very dysregulation, that it then claims it has to police with hard borders and state power.
The system also built the agricultural networks and supply chains that prevent mass starvation, which, historically speaking, is the ultimate dysregulator of human nervous systems.
let's pull back and look at where this leaves us. My position throughout this debate has been that the formal architecture of society, the dashboards, the margins, the economic regulations, will only generate destruction unless it is completely infused with the living, warm grammar of the human call.
Because measuring what is present isn't enough.
Exactly. If we measure only what is present on the dashboard, we completely ignore what is absent and urgently needed on the ground. If we value only what can be quantified and exchanged, we destroy the relational gifts that actually sustain life. We have to ground our global systems in truthful naming, the evolved nest of human development, and an unwavering structural commitment to provisioning life capacity for everyone. Without that living grammar guiding us, our formal structures are just perfectly engineered machines accelerating us toward collapse.
And my summary is that while the concepts of interbeing and the grammar of the call beautifully articulate the depth of the human condition, we absolutely cannot discard the cold, rigorous architecture of constraints. Subjective phenomenological calls are simply too easily manipulated by counterfeit relevance, algorithmic outrage, and fear.
Even with life value as a filter?
Yes, because implementing that filter at scale requires structure. While the gift is a noble, vital concept in our local communities, scaled global societies require the structured equivalence of exchange to prevent the coerced sacrifice of the vulnerable. If we abandon objective systemic architecture in our romantic pursuit of an answered life, we risk dissolving the very mechanisms, the supply chains, the legal borders, the regulatory frameworks that keep complex global systems from descending into unmanageable chaos.
But we do arrive at a profound point of convergence today, even if we, disagree on the mechanics. We both look at the world and acknowledge that the current global operating system is suffering a severe meta crisis.
Agreed. It is clearly failing to capture the full scope of what keeps a civilization viable.
And we both see that the current system systematically misnames reality. It looks at the extraction of the natural world and calls it development. It looks at violence, hard borders, and domination and calls it security.
Yeah, we completely agree that the metrics are currently broken and they are filtering out the cries of the vulnerable.
Which reveals the immense value of holding both of these perspectives in tension. We absolutely need your structural systemic constraints to manage the staggering complexity of 8 billion people. But those structures must be guided, corrected, and continuously interrupted by the felt phenomenological calls of life to ensure the machinery is actually serving humanity. Dr. Solly's work offers a profound, necessary avenue to explore exactly how we strike that balance.
It forces us to ask the hardest question. How do we build the rigorous architecture to survive without losing the humanity inside the building?
Which brings us right back to that control room we started in. The dashboard is essential. It gives us the parameters, the load limits, and the margins of error. We need it to keep the grid running, but it is only the living grammar of the call, the crying child, the grieving community, the dry riverbed, that tells us who we are actually keeping the lights on for. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.